Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 3 weeks, media around the globe have extensively covered the brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old medical student on a moving bus in New Delhi, India. On December 29th, the woman died of her injuries in Singapore, where she was being treated. Six men were charged with the crimes just yesterday. In the first Post piece, What One 23-Year-Old Taught Us, today's guest, Sandeep Roy, writes, quote, "The larger question that must haunt us is this. What is it about us that makes us so prone not just to rape, but to gang rape? Why has that become the weapon of choice for men to exert power, whether it's over a woman in a bus or a boy in a hostel? There will be many articles, seminars, panels to address all this in the days to come. The 23-year-old rape victim's life ended at a Singapore hospital, and it's up to us now to choose how her story will end," end quote. Sandeep Roy is the culture editor of First Post. That's a website that offers news and analysis about India and the globe. He provides commentaries for NPR. And of course, he's former co-host of Your Call. And Sandeep joins us from Calcutta, India. Hi, Sandeep. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Good to speak with you.
Well, it's great to have you, and I wish we had you on for a story that wasn't so horrific, but your piece has gotten a lot of attention. And before we talk about that, as you know, on Friday, as we always do, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was reported well?
Well, Rose, I mean, as you can guess, a lot of the stuff that I was reading this week had to do with the rape story. And I think one of the things that I would give kudos to is Emma O'Toole, who wrote a piece in The Guardian, which looked at how the rape story was being covered in the media in the West, particularly a piece by, I think, Libby Purvis in The Times, where, you know, she talked about the West looking at India, looking eastward in disgust. And one of the things Emma O'Toole was pointing out in the piece that while, say, the Wall Street Journal decries the fact that in India, just over a quarter of alleged rapists are convicted, in the U.S., in fact, only 24% of alleged rapes even result in an arrest, mm-hmm. never mind a conviction. And then similarly, sort of comparing the numbers in Delhi to sort of proportionally the numbers in England and Wales to say it's not so much, you know, that you don't have to look in disgust or not in disgust. You know, this, you can look in perhaps in look east in solidarity and support without, and at the same time, you do have to look into your own backyard as well.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought this up because Alorma Chowdhury with the Department of Women's Studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston said the same thing, that you're seeing a lot of reports pointing fingers at what she calls Indian culture, values and attitudes and its animalistic male population.
Right.
Talking about the fact that these men were from the slums, and this is included in a lot of the stories. So have you seen this in many articles, and what are your thoughts about it? And do you think that...
Well, there was one story in, you know, which talked about the hyena-like quality of Indian men. And I was speaking with a friend yesterday who works with a non-governmental organization, and she said, you know, you see, like, the Indian male has suddenly become the monster of choice, you know, replacing, for example, the Saudi male or you know, other kind of racialized monster characteristics, but which sort of ignores the fact that these issues around misogyny, patriarchy, things that lead to rape and molestation and all of that is part of something that is actually a global problem. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem in some ways of looking at it the other way and saying, like, look, you know, countries in like the U.S. and Scandinavia also have serious problems in this regard is not to say that Indian men can be given a pass, you know, to say that, oh, because it is everybody's problem, therefore it is nobody's problem at all, but to really look at it and see, of course, there are certain cultural things that are very specific to India and which India will have to deal with. I mean, this, you know, one of the things that has been annoying about this, the coverage that is about the rape issue is that so many Indian leaders keep talking about, you know, this is like we have to protect our sisters and our daughters, and, you know, they should remember that these are like our sisters and daughters, as if as if you were not somebody's sister or daughter, then it is, you know, that, you know, that relationship is the only relationship that is worthwhile. And it is, and the fact that you are brutalized by these guys and stripped and left naked on the side of the road is only shocking because you're someone's sister or daughter. You know, that narrative is like very difficult to shake.
Right. Well, and so it's interesting because you've got what happened in India, a global problem. We've covered, for example, military rape on the show in the U.S. extensively. And so why don't you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in the Indian press? First Post, the website that you work with, has a number of stories. For example, No Trial by Mob, The Answer to Gang Rape Cannot Be Gang Justice. Another story, Naming Anti-Rape Law After Victim is an Act of Empty Symbolism. What else are you seeing in the Indian media?
It's kind of hard to open the newspapers these days without seeing some stories. And in fact, one of the interesting things that's happened is it's almost like the journalists here have like suddenly gone on the rape beat, as it were. So not just about this particular gang rape story, but like a lot of today's newspaper, for example, had a story about a woman who was traveling on a train who apparently was molested by a soldier traveling on that same train, and she jumped off the train and the soldier was arrested. On the flip side, you have stories about a political leader in the northeastern state of Assam who was accused of raping a woman in a village, and the villagers, a lot of them women, surrounded him and in the morning and beat him up and stripped him and refused to hand him over to the police until he wrote in an affidavit that indeed he had molested this woman. So there's like a lot of coverage around the issues of rape, as well as, you know, what should be the punishment, you know, whether capital punishment is the way to go, stories about whether chemical castration, for example, is effective. But what several people have pointed out is that a lot of it has focused on the punishment issue. For example, one of the six charged is a minor, you know, whether the minor should be charged in the same way as an adult or not. So a lot of it has been focusing on the punishment issue. And the other thing that has happened is there's definitely been a brave heart narrative that's been going on. In fact, this young woman has been sort of nicknamed Braveheart by a lot of the media. And that was one of the points I tried to raise in my piece, where it was saying that, you know, she wasn't a Braveheart in that sense. You know, we are making a hero out of her right now, whereas she was just this ordinary young woman who got on a bus to go home. That's all she was trying to do. She was not seeking to become a candle or inspire a nation. You know, it's great that the people's consciences were jolted by this, but that is not what, you know, you have to always remember, that's not what she was trying to do. She was just trying to go home.
We're speaking with Sandeep Roy about media coverage of the horrific gang rape of a 23-year-old medical student on a moving bus in New Delhi, coming home from seeing a movie. She died of her injuries in Singapore, where she was being treated on December 29th, and six men were charged with the crimes yesterday. There are calls for everything from chemical castration to the death penalty. And if you'd like to weigh in on this, if you'd like to talk about the coverage, because it has received extensive global coverage over the past 3 weeks, Sandeep will be with us for another 5 or 10 minutes. Now would be a good time to give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about how this is being covered? And what about criticism of the Western media saying that we need to look at these Indian men who lived in slums, but when you look at global statistics, that rape is widespread across the globe. What are your thoughts on that? You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Sam in San Francisco. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Hello, Rose and Sandeep. I admittedly get most of my information from the radio. I listen to public radio, and I haven't been looking at television or other sources, but I have been frustrated in feeling that this story, which has been certainly extensively referred to every hour on the hour for quite a few days now, I feel like I hear the same three sentences over and over and over again. A young woman was raped on a bus, gang raped. I've heard nothing about the attackers. as far as, you know, who were they? What were their ages? Were they adults? Were they youths? What were the circumstances? It seemed that weeks went by before I heard much detail at all about, oh, was the bus moving, not moving? I'm sorry if this seems prurient. I don't mean it to be. I just feel that the information has been very, very, in such a basic, cartoonish presentation of the same repeated sentences over and over again that I wonder why that is. And I'd like to hear your comments on that, yeah. Please.
Thank you, Sam. Sandeep, what are your thoughts about that, the specific details?
I don't necessarily know how it was reported in the radio over there, but here I have to say, I would give some kudos to the media here, is that for one of the few times that I've noticed that when this rape happened, that the coverage actually here did focus a lot more on the attackers instead of the victim, where, you know, here you don't reveal the name of the victim. The media often ends up playing this strange game of 20 questions whereby they reveal every other biographical detail about her except her name. So it becomes very easy in the area she might have been in to figure out who she is. And also one of the things that did not happen mostly, even though there were some notable political exceptions, is that nobody went around talking about, what she was wearing, or in other ways, how she might have tempted her own, you know, brought this upon herself. So there was less of the blame the victim, and there was coverage of who the attackers were, and people, reporters actually went to the area in which they lived, and someone even went to the village where a couple of them were from. So to answer Sam's question, there were six men who attacked her. Actually, one of them is a minor who's 6 months under 18, I think, and the other six were... They all sort of lived in the same sort of slum area, and they had various jobs. One was a bus driver. One worked as an attendant in a gym. Another person sold fruits and vegetables. And that has led to a certain amount of criticism where a lot of the reaction is because of the class fears and stuff, you know, because of the class difference. But there has actually been significant amount of coverage of the attackers, even though some of it was a little scary and nerve-wracking for me, because, you know, when I heard about reporters trudging to a very remote village and thrusting a microphone in the front of the poor villagers who are the parents of two of the attackers were brothers, and saying, like, your son did this, you know, what do you think? It made me feel a little queasy, because I didn't know whether these people would have had the wherewithal to just say, like, I don't want to comment on this.
Mm. Well, and also, to provide some more details, your website First Post quotes Z News, and the woman's friend told Z News that a male accompanied this woman. They were together. And right. they were both beaten and thrown off the bus, and he said that people were just watching. Nobody came to help them. Rickshaws passed, cars, bikes slowed down, but no one stopped. Right. And then he said PCR vans, I guess those are ambulances, they arrived 45 minutes after these two were thrown out of the bus, and even at the hospital, they had to beg for clothing.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, that's Rose, one of the things that in here, I think a lot of the reaction is also a part of, you know, part of the strong feelings people have towards the attackers, which is in about rage and anger at the brutality of the attack. Part of it, I cannot help but think, is related to the fact that, like, how much, as a culture, we are complicit in turning our faces away and looking away from smaller instances of molestation, or a woman who is on a bus, you know, getting harassed by a group of boys who are teasing her or passing comments about her. And we've been sort of schooled almost to not get into it and not protest, because you don't want to bring trouble upon yourself. Mm. And I think there is that kind of cumulative guilt that is prevailing in society, which people don't necessarily want to talk about. So in a sense, sometimes when you call for capital punishment or summary execution or chemical castration of these particular rapists, yeah, there is a little bit of deflecting that guilt that, you know, socially is definitely there amongst everybody.
We have a few emails about this. Catherine in Scotts Valley says, what the media is not saying is that the men tortured her. Her organs failed because they inserted a steel rod into her body, per other early news reports. Then they callously threw her from the bus. Did they commandeer the bus? The whole story is not being told. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know about that yet, but I mean, the iron rod that was inserted in her is definitely been a huge part of the narrative here. And I should think, in fact, if that had not happened, I don't know if the case would have elicited as much of a huge reaction, because, I mean, unfortunately, rapes are not that out of the ordinary in this country, or even in Delhi in particular. And I think that is why the chief minister of Delhi, who had gotten so much flack for it afterwards, was initially like kind of dismissive of it, saying basically the bus was a private company bus and not a Delhi government bus, and therefore outside her jurisdiction. She was very dismissive, and I wrote a piece about that at that time. But I think she was probably thinking, like, yes, I mean, you know, it's a rape, but these things happen at night when women are out and about. You know, it'll blow over in a couple of days. But I think, in fact, the iron rod being inserted in her and her intestines being so badly mangled and damaged that even the doctors said they had never seen somebody arrive in the hospital in that state. Mm. That, I think, was actually the shocking sort of trigger point that flipped the switch, as it were.
And thank you for the email, Catherine. And Jackie writes and says, she died, so it is murder, which was the intent of the rapists. This was way beyond rape. We also have a problem, an email from Monica, who says, I take issue with what Sandeep just said about remembering that this young woman did not set out to be a symbol. Rosa Parks did not set out to be a symbol either when she sat in a prohibited part of the bus because she was just tired, yet she became a symbol for the injustice of the segregated system.
Yes and no. I mean, but Rosa Parks was also somebody who was, you know, she was not, you know, she was also training and working. I mean, she wasn't just a random person who didn't get up from the bus, right?
Right. Well, and in India, again, every 20 minutes a rape is reported, and many women don't report the rape, so the figures are much higher. Sandeep, where do you think this story should go from here? I mean, your piece has gotten a lot of attention. This is getting worldwide attention for the last 3 weeks. I'm getting a number of petitions. It's not going away anytime soon. Where do you think the media should take this from here?
I think the focus, I mean, honestly, Rose, I mean, there is obviously the larger sort of systemic thing, but the two things to address around culture and patriarchy and misogyny and sort of the continuum from, you know, the female fetus that is aborted to the rape, and this rape being sort of the horrific extreme end of a larger continuum of violence and discrimination and all of that. So that is sort of the long-term cultural change that we're talking about changing the conversation. But the two things that I think the media needs to keep an eye on here is, right now, like, let this rape case not be the exceptional rape case where the punishment meted out to the rapist sort of becomes the end of the story, whether it's capital punishment or whatever. But one of the major things that has to happen in this country is a change in the attitudes of the police, so that a woman, when something like this happens to a woman, she does not basically get, you know, sort of virtually raped again by the act of going into a police station to file a complaint and not being believed, being asked out on a date. The Helka, the investigative magazine, did a sting last year with policemen in Delhi, where policemen basically said that, you know, 7 out of only 1 or 2% of rape cases are genuine. So if a woman gets into a car with multiple men, chances are she's actually having a relationship with one of them anyway. And in fact, the genuine rapes don't really get reported, because someone who is genuinely raped, as in an innocent victim, would be too ashamed to report that. Most rapes that people talk about are just deals that have gone wrong. So there is a huge thing that has to happen at the police level to inspire a certain level of confidence in it. And I think the other thing that has to be talked about in this country, and which media can talk about, is the fact that the focus right now is on what happened to this bus, because this becomes an issue of governance, that a government cannot provide a public bus system enough that is safe enough for a woman to get on at 10 o'clock at night. But in fact, the fact is most rapes actually occur at home. And that is not being, you know, necessarily addressed in all of this. You know, as a friend of mine who works for a non-governmental organization said, go into any burn ward in a hospital, and two-thirds of the patients there are young women with third-degree burns from you know, that they have sustained at home from in-laws, husbands. So most of the rapes happen at home from people you know. And, you know, and that part of the narrative is easy to avoid when you can fixate on six drunk men who came out of a slum.
Well, her friend also, at the end of this article, said when he had a conversation with her, she said she did not want to die. And unfortunately, she did die on December 29th at a hospital in Singapore. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sandeep. We'll be following your reporting on this, and we'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying up. That is Sandeep Roy. He is culture editor for First Post. Check out this website. It offers news and analysis about India and the globe. We've got a link to his story, What One 23-Year-Old Taught Us. Sandeep offers commentaries for NPR. I'm sure you hear them on a regular basis. And of course, he's a former co-host of Your Call. And this is Your Call. It's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we're going to switch gears now and talk about media coverage of the 150-plus page fiscal cliff bill. And joining us to talk about this is David K. Johnston, columnist for Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, what the final deal actually accomplished. Because it was a last-minute deal. President Obama walked into these talks looking for $1.2 trillion in revenue. He said he was firm on this number, ended up coming out with $620 billion in revenue. And The New Yorker's John Cassidy wrote, quote, "It's a shoddy compromise that does credit to nobody involved, and it raises questions once again about President Obama's willingness and ability to face down the Republican extremists," end quote. So what is your assessment of the final deal and President Obama's role in all of this?
Well, let's look at this in a couple of pieces. First of all, it's important to understand this was not in any way comprehensive tax reform. That has not been addressed, all right? So if you are one of the long-term unemployed, because we have fewer jobs now than we had 5 years ago, this is an important piece of legislation because it allowed you to continue to collect unemployment benefits. And 6 million Americans in 2012, that's statistically every 50th person in the country, had no income except food stamps.
Wow.
They didn't even have unemployment benefits. That is not the kind of economy that we had before the radical Bush tax cuts that I've demonstrated in a lot of writings didn't do any of the things we were promised that they would do. As for the revenue side.
And so just quickly, on the unemployment benefits. So we're talking about 6 million people, and these were going to expire. So how long?
No. It's a different number.
Oh.
There are 6 million people who don't have any unemployment benefits anyway. They've already exhausted them.
Oh, okay.
And their only income is food stamps. And, of course, one of the things the Republicans want desperately to do is radically cut back food stamps. That is, they want to take people and put them in a position of begging for food.
Oh, my. So how many?
Then there is, I believe the number is around 3 million, but I'm sure some caller knows the correct number. It's not coming up in my head at the moment, of people whose unemployment benefits would have stopped on December 31st, but for this legislation.
Okay, so they have been extended. And for how long? And do you know the average benefit per month?
Oh, the average benefit, well, benefits are only paid weekly, and the average benefit's quite small. It's in the range of, depending on the state you live in, it's higher or lower, but nationally it's in the $200 to $300 range. overall.
Okay. And hold that thought, David. We are going to take a quick break. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we will be back right after this.
Back to the second half of your call in just a moment. There are many ways to take part in our daily conversation, on the phone, via email, or on our website, yourcallradio.org. The number to call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or leave an email question or comment at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Tamim Ansari, Afghan-American writer and author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. We will speak with him about the people's history of Afghanistan. That is on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea for the new year, 2013, or any suggestions for what you'd like us to do this year, we'd love to hear from you. Feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're speaking right now with David K. Johnston. He is a columnist with Tax Analyst and the Columbia Journalism Review. A little later in the show, we'll be joined by Adele Iskandar, co-editor of Jadalia. We'll be talking about Al Jazeera's acquisition of Al Gore's Current TV for a reported $500 million. We're speaking with David K. Johnston about media coverage of the fiscal cliff bill. And you've been following this for months. We've been covering this for months. What are your thoughts now that it's done? What are your thoughts on the bill and the media coverage? What was in the bill? We'll talk about corporate subsidies, special deals for people who've got lobbyists or organizations and corporations that have lobbyists in D.C. What are your thoughts on the reporting on this? And if you saw a story this week that you think deserved more attention or you want to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Okay, David, so unemployment benefits, the deal did not create additional benefits for unemployed workers who have already exhausted their benefits. It did for 3 million people. For how long?
It varies from state to state, depending on how these work. But some of these people continue to get benefits for a number of weeks into this year.
Okay.
So that's one important measure. Now, a second thing that happened here is that it does raise taxes on the 150 million people who have jobs. For 2 years, at the insistence of Republicans, we have had a 2 percentage point reduction in the withholding taxes paid for Social Security. Instead of 6.4%, it was 4.4%. If you make $25,000 a year, that is a $500 tax increase. If you make the maximum, which is around $113,000, you're talking about a $2,200 tax increase. So there is a non-income tax increase that goes in here. The temporary, and it was intended to be temporary, stimulus reduction in Social Security taxes ended.
So who are the winners and losers when we're talking about taxes?
Now we get to the other part of this picture, and that is all the tax rates basically remain the same except for high-income earners. Those people who make married couples $450,000 or more, we're talking now about within the top 1%, okay?
Okay.
But for all practical purposes, the top 1%. On their earned income, that is money you get from your job or a business if you're a sole proprietor, your tax rate above the $450,000 will go up from 35% to 39.6%. Basically, you'll pay a nickel more out of every dollar. If you make $1 million, you make $1,450,000 as a married couple, all from salary, you'll pay an extra $50,000 of tax. People who make $1 million a day, and we have people in America who make $1 million a day, will pay the same rate as a two-income couple that I just described who work all year to make a little over $1 million a year, all right? So that's one. The second thing that happens is that we have gone back to something introduced back in the 90s where married couples who make more than $300,000 will have their itemized deductions reduced at $30 for every thousand, 3% for every $1,000. So for a couple who make $500,000, they would lose $6,000 of their deductions. If they had $50,000 in deductions, they'll get $44,000 in deductions. That's another tax increase on them. The shortcomings in this are that the amount of money this is going to raise, the White House says, is $620 billion over 10 years. That is not anywhere near close to deal with the deficit. The deficit last year was over $1 trillion because of the weak economy and the Bush tax cuts. It is on a downward slope. Obama has been doing a good job of reducing the deficit. But what you're now going to see is a huge fight over reducing spending, and the Republicans have made it very clear where they want to reduce spending. They do not want to touch the military budget. Mm. We spend about 44% of all the military spending in the world. And what they want to cut are what they call entitlements. That's a politically loaded phrase for Republicans. That's code for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It isn't things like the huge interest-free loans that businesses and individuals can get through the tax system. It isn't subsidies that companies are entitled to because of laws they got passed, their lobbying and campaign contributions. It is entirely aimed at the vast majority of Americans who the Republicans believe should get fewer benefits from the government, but whom they don't think should pay higher taxes for them.
What is the status of the cuts we were supposed to see in the military budget?
The so-called sequester, which, as Obama said during the campaign, it ain't going to happen, was an automatic series of cuts in government spending, 8%. Because of the way government spending works, it's no different than corporate spending. You can't just suddenly cut 8%. There are contracts that Congress has already approved and authorized that extend, you know, a decade or two into the future, and commitments that have been made. So they've put this off for 2 months to try and figure out what they're going to do to reduce spending. And, of course, there is the ceiling on the debt limit coming up. Putting a ceiling on the debt limit is a relatively modern invention. It came about during the last century. And you're going to see a lot of argument about this, and you're going to hear a lot of noise that Congress hasn't passed a budget. There is no requirement in the Constitution for a budget. The country existed for more than 100 years without a budget.
And the president recently signed the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, right? So $633 billion. And when he signed this, he said, it will ensure the U.S. will continue to have the, quote, strongest military in the world. I've been sort of out of pocket for last couple of weeks. Was there much debate on this Defense Authorization Act?
No, not at all. And it's important to recognize that defense is only one part of the national security budget, which is over $1 trillion a year. In fact, the national security budget altogether costs more than the individual income tax raises from everybody in America, because you have to include in that budget Veterans Affairs, that's past wars expenses,
right.
Homeland Security, diplomacy, ICE, a whole variety of government things that are beyond the Pentagon. The CIA, the biggest security agency, the National Security Agency, they do all the electronic eavesdropping. Those are all included in those costs. And what I'm concerned we're not going to have is a debate about whether we need to change our military doctrine, which is now designed to fight two full-scale wars on two different continents simultaneously. I don't see any prospect of that on the horizon, and I think the number of the generals and admirals have said they don't either. So why don't we change our military budget to reflect the future? Well, you know, the generals and admirals, it is often said, often want to refight the last war.
And we ask this question regularly on this show, but I'll ask it again, considering you had the fiscal cliff debate happening, and then you had the military bill being signed almost simultaneously. What role did the media play? Did they ask politicians about these two very important bills and why there's so much focus on cutting social services, Social Security, Medicare, and not on the military.
And not really. I mean, yes, I've seen questions asked and collected stories indicate questions were asked, but there's no challenging of answers that have nothing to do with the question asked. Mm. That's part of the problem. The era here when reporters could say, I'm sorry, Senator, you're not answering the question, or Senator, that's nonsense. Let me ask the question again. You get fired for those things these days.
We're speaking with David K. Johnston, columnist with Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review, about media coverage of the fiscal cliff bill and then, again, the military spending bill just signed by President Obama, $633 billion. And if you have any comments or questions about media coverage of this, what really stood out for you on coverage of these two issues? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. And if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org and leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. David, I was just on vacation in Belize for a couple of weeks. What's so striking to me is meeting Canadians and Europeans who they all ask the same question. What is going on in your country? Why do you have such a huge military budget? Why do you pay so much for college? We go to medical school and law school for free in many countries. And why is it so expensive for your health care? Every single person asks me this question.
Yeah, it is. As soon as you step outside the United States and talk to people who are at all educated, those are the very questions that they raise. And they're just astonished at what's gone on. We have, unfortunately, created a political culture that is focused on interests that are not the public interest. And it is causing us enormous economic damage. And let me just give you a killer number that when I was a columnist at Reuters, I used in my next to last column. You compare what are called purchasing parity dollars, so they're really comparable dollars, the United States to the other 33 modern economies of the world. Every dollar that they spend per person on health care, and they all have universal health care, unlike America, we spend $2.64 for every dollar that they spend. That excess spending alone is an enormous drag on us. If we had the French system, one of the most expensive systems in the world after ours, the difference in savings to the universal system the French have with no out-of-pocket expense to our system, the difference in savings in 2010 was the equivalent of eliminating the individual income tax for every American. We have these unbelievably inefficient systems, but we have all sorts of lobbyists in Washington who are the source of either campaign contributions for you or the threat of contributions to get you thrown out of office if you don't maintain our existing systems in healthcare, military, and converting college from an investment in the future into a business for today.
Well, and to that point, the Huffington Post and many other, I don't know about many other, but the Chronicle also had a piece about the fiscal cliff and all of the pork. And so just a couple things that stand out here, $43 million over 2 years for NASCAR, Hollywood studio subsidies, $150 million for the last 2 years. Mining companies are going to have some subsidies, $9 billion offshore financing loophole for banks, tax credits for foreign subsidies. What else stands out for you? Who got big deals
that's
here?
That's the list of the big items in there. And this is the kind of horse trading that goes on in Washington. We are subsidizing athletics in this country, commercial athletics, to a tremendous degree, that we are letting the owners of NASCAR motorways write off their investments more quickly for tax purposes is a good example of by what priority does that get a special favor, especially when 6 million Americans have no income except food stamps.
Right.
This is a fundamental underlying problem. And one of the real problems of this, by the way, Rose, is that tax legislation is not tied to any congressperson. Things appear literally out of nowhere and get inserted into bills. And even if you work very hard at it, you often can't find out who really was behind this or that provision. I think transparency, where every tax legislation, every subsidy through the tax system is the subject of this congressman or this senator proposed it, is an open hearing on it, there's public comment on it, would dramatically reduce this mining of the federal treasury that is simply redistribution of wealth upward.
Well, thanks to the Sunlight Foundation, they have listed all of this pork and these special deals, and you can find information about this. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. That's David K. Johnston. He's a columnist with Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review. We're talking about media coverage of the fiscal cliff bill, and we also talked a little bit about the military spending bill, and these bills rarely get much scrutiny. And joining us now is Adel Iskandar. He's co-editor of Judd Aliyah. That's an e-zine that provides commentary and news about the Middle East. And Al Jazeera this week acquired Al Gore's Current TV for a reported $500 million. Al Jazeera plans to use Current to launch a news channel based in New York with bureaus in L.A., Miami, Washington, and Chicago. It has the potential to reach 60 million people, but shortly after the deal was reached, Time Warner said it was immediately dropping Current TV from its lineup. This Al Jazeera, of course, is the network that was scrutinized heavily by the Bush administration. Many of them called it a terrorist organization because they aired videos from Al-Qaeda. And Adel, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So I was struck by some of the coverage. They just called Al Jazeera controversial. It was almost in many of the leads. But before we get to that, though, why do you think Al Jazeera would spend $500 million? This is a lot of money for a network that a lot of people don't really watch.
Well, I think for the most part, you have to look at the pedigree of Al Jazeera to really understand why decisions are made in the manner that they are. Al Jazeera is funded almost entirely by the royal family of Qatar, a small peninsular state in the Arabian / Persian Gulf. And for the most part, they've spent at least $1 billion to set up the English language network some years ago. And about $140 million to set up the Arabic language predecessor in 1996. So this is, an emirate that has very deep pockets. It has the second largest natural gas reserves and is pitching to become an influential media player in the world. And so for the most part, $500 million is actually not that hefty a cost for accessing the U.S. Audience market. This is something they've been trying to do for at least the last 5 to 6 years, but the footprint has been quite minuscule. They've only been able to access a few cable markets in the United States, very small cities like Burlington, Vermont. Recently, in the last couple of years, they were able to get New York and D.C., but again, very, very small cable providers, not sort of national cable companies. So this is an opportunity for them to increase their footprint substantially and be available on cable to a large market share in the United States. And for them, the U.S. public and the U.S. audience is really sort of a hinge on a variety of levels. Key political decisions are made by the public here in the U.S., the political electorate that can affect international policy. So this is, this is a very, very highly sought after audience, one that very few other international broadcasters have ever been able to reach. You look at, for instance, BBC or Deutsche Welle or some of the French networks or any other network from around the world. They've had an extremely difficult time accessing the U.S. media market share. So this is quite a historic moment for international broadcasting in the U.S. market.
And how significant was Time Warner's decision? Shortly after this acquisition was made, they immediately dropped Current TV, and Current TV through Time Warner reaches New York and L.A., about 12 million subscribers.
Absolutely. I think, it speaks for, the reputation that Al Jazeera has. It is, I would agree that Al Jazeera is a controversial brand. I'm not going to call it a network because now Al Jazeera is a series of different products. There's Al Jazeera English, which broadcasts internationally. There's Al Jazeera Arabic, its predecessor, which broadcasts primarily to Arabic-speaking audiences. And, of course, there are other networks geared towards different communities in the Balkans, a future project in Turkey. So it's difficult to speak with unanimity about the Al Jazeera product, but wherever Al Jazeera goes, there is an element of controversy, largely because of the way they do journalism. And they're not all one and the same. The Arabic network has been controversial because of its position in support of various oppositional groups in the Arab world during a time of authoritarianism. And today is even more controversial because of what appears to be its steadfast support of various Islamist groups and Islamist political forces in the region, such as the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Hamas in Palestine, the opposition groups and the Free Syrian Army in Syria, and various other outfits. So Al Jazeera comes with a lot of political baggage to the American market share, and really it's basically a hot potato for American cable companies. They're concerned at what this might mean, what it might entail, and how audiences are going to react to it. There really isn't an indication as to whether or not American audiences are going to embrace the network and say, "Wow, this is fantastic work." So it's a tricky decision. I think the decision by Time wanted to step away from Al Jazeera now is an indication of what will become, I think, an uphill battle for the network to really make inroads into the American market, both in terms of audiences and in terms of carriage by cable companies. It could be the beginning of an exodus by cable companies and avoiding the network. Mm-hmm. But that may not be the case. It's hard to tell.
That is Adel Iskandar, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that provides commentary and news about the Middle East. We're talking about Al Jazeera's reported $500 million acquisition of Al Gore's Current TV. And David K. Johnston, you regularly appear on CNN, MSNBC. What are your thoughts about this acquisition and what it might mean for the cable market?
Terrible decision by Time Warner. I think that Americans should be appalled about this. It is one of the problems with the quote-unquote deregulation of cable companies. Instead of being common carriers, they instead influence what you see. And, for example, Comcast is the majority owner of NBC. Comcast is also a cable company, and they have been trying to give precedence to their shows in terms of traffic on the Internet. The suggestion by your other guest that, they're controversial at Al Jazeera. So what? I mean, what controversial? I mean, what does that mean? It means people talk about it. That's all controversial means. Does it have a perspective? Yes. Do they have a reputation for thoroughly reporting the news and breaking major news stories? They sure do. They have a perspective? Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. We're afraid to hear that perspective. Now, I'm somebody who subscribes to both The Nation and The National Review. So perhaps I'm a little unusual about that, but I believe in free speech. And here you have a credible, well-financed news source that has a different perspective, a perspective that isn't the low-budget operations of two of the cable networks, that isn't an openly biased arm of the Republican Party, Fox News or Faux News, as some of us call it, and that isn't CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, is affiliated with the cable company. They have split it, but there's a long history here, and gives us, an American perspective on things. Mm. So I think, by the way, in many cities in this country, you can also watch the Chinese government's propaganda channel from Beijing. Let's have lots of different voices, and out of that we will get wisdom.
What about that, Adel? What about that use of the word controversial? What does that mean exactly?
Well, I mean, I agree with David on this issue of, we need plurality in the American media system. We've been very insular for a long time. I just so happen to be the co-author of the first book ever published about Al Jazeera in 2002, where I spoke, both my co-author and myself spoke very, very positively about the network. And, of course, the English language outfit is extremely professional. They do, work that very few networks here in the United States can venture into, especially when it comes to international coverage. So they come with enough accolades, to really push them forward. But despite that, I think it's important to note that the Al Jazeera of 2006 and 2010 and 2011 is very different from Al Jazeera today, not the English outfit. I follow every network that belongs to the Al Jazeera family, and the Arabic station has transformed, metamorphosized almost completely into...
Adel, sorry to cut you off. I just want to... We have a caller who's been waiting, and I just realized we're almost out of time, so I just want to quickly take Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, yes, there are a lot of questions I could ask. I want to note that Gavin Newsom was quick to scurry away from Current TV immediately after this was announced. It wasn't just Time Warner, but I wanted to ask David K. Johnson. Richard Wolff maintains that in the Eisenhower era, the tax rates for the wealthy were almost confiscatory, and I wanted to know if you could give a brief couple minutes talking about how these tax rates have come down over the decades and during which administrations. I think it would be beneficial.
Okay, and Harry, since you mentioned Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, current lieutenant governor of California, who was an analyst or a host, actually, on Current TV, just to let listeners know. What are your thoughts on that question about Eisenhower and tax rates,
well,
David?
Well, the top marginal tax rate in this country was on unearned income, that is investment income, was 91% during the Eisenhower years, and Eisenhower, of course, was a Republican. During Nixon, the top tax rate was 70%. Reagan brought the top tax rate down to 50 and then ultimately to 28. We're now back at 39.6. But I think it's very important to point out that throughout this period, if you go back to 1961, the first year of the Kennedy administration, and compare it with, I think it's 2010, I did the analysis of, the share of income paid by the top 398 taxpayers in income taxes has fallen 60 percentage points. Hmm. They've gotten a 60%, I'm sorry, from 45 down to 17 or 18. And the rate paid by the bottom 90% of Americans went down only a third as much. And when you add in the increased Social Security taxes, the bottom 90% are paying higher rates now than in the 50s. And those at the very top are paying much lower rates. That's been, I think, the important story is raising the burden on the vast majority and lowering the burden on the very top.
So just quickly, David, we're almost out of time. Are we going to continue to see massive social service cuts in the coming year?
Only if people don't rise up and say no. If people just say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it, or we think that's a good idea, yes, we will see that. If people go to their congresspeople and say, what are you doing here? We paid for taxes for these benefits. Why are you cutting them? Go cut other things, particularly our national security spending that is wasteful and doesn't address our actual national security concerns.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll continue to follow this. David K. Johnston, columnist with Tax Analysts, author of the excellent book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Adele Iskandar, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that provides commentary and news about the Middle East. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday.
What is the people's history of Afghanistan? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Tamim Ansari, Afghan-American writer and author of Games Without Rules, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan. He tells the story of Afghanistan since the seeds of the modern country first began to germinate in the mid-1750s. What is the socio-political history of Afghanistan, and what do we still need to know about that country? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I said, let's get that pacemaker out. And they looked at me. You want it out? You have to take it out. I said, I've never done that before. They gave me this wonderful nonverbal Bengali head waddle.
Join us for the Mock Radio Hour. True stories told live. From the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Moth Radio Hour in its new time slot, new day and time, Sunday at 6 p.m. following selected shorts here on KALW San Francisco. Next from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show. And then Tavis and Dr. Cornell West with Smiley and West this afternoon at 1. 11 o'clock is the time, and this is 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio online, kalw.org.
Namaste, and welcome to a special edition of World Have Your Say from a rooftop restaurant in Delhi.
After 5 years, I'd be hoping I don't have to call my girlfriend up and asking her, have you reached safely home? Every single time she goes out.
Around 20 of us are gathered here on this cold night to discuss our feelings in the wake of the terrible gang rape and murder of a young woman in our city. There has been anger, fear, and outrage, but also new conversations have taken place about how we, as Indian people, treat our women. Join us. Take part in our conversation in the usual ways. On Facebook, on the phone, or on Twitter, using the hashtag WHYS.